All right, we're continuing our series on Marsha McLuhan's Mosaic by Elena Lamberti. And we finished part one. Now we're doing part two, which is called Modernist Ascendancies. There's that word, ascending. And the first section in part two is chapter seven, McLuhan and Media Studies, which is page 123. So it's called, a little subsection, first part, Labeling the Media Theorist. So it's talking about labeling McLuhan?
Yep. So the first clip is right at the top of the page. In an essay written for a new volume on modernism, I suggested the advantages of cross-reading media studies and literary studies in order to better understand certain aspects of cultural phenomenon pertaining to the early 20th century. So this is Lamberti talking about how she's taking some of McLuhan's, I guess, theories and putting them into work for her. So in that essay, she says, I offered an overall approach to some modernist poetics in the light of the study of the new communications technologies of the time, bracket, telegraph, telephone, radio, as well as the new journalism. And the press approached as objective correlatives of electricity and of electric media.
Objective correlatives is a T.S. Eliot word.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, radio and then electricity and electric media.
Yeah, it's like objective correlatives means effects. The press is an effect of electricity and electric media.
Okay, good, good. She continues, I adopted an interdisciplinary approach inspired by Marsha McLuhan's understanding of both literature and society. The underpinning intention in my essay was to convince colleagues that not only was McLuhan's literary criticism quite good and still neglected, but that the Canadian thinker had also fully explore the pivotal role both literature and the arts have to play with the high-tech society. So she was set out to do this, but you only have to look at that. Look at literature, arts, and high-tech. And you know people aren't going to be interested in what they think is trying to be expert in three things in order to critique it or understand it or play with it. So it's kind of a lost cause except for a person with a good brain. Right, Bob?
She's trying to, you know, everybody left this country and we're in a new country and she insists on us remembering key events from the old country.
Yeah.
And people might have time when they're drunk in a tavern to reminisce about old country stuff, but it's not part of their life.
And she also wants you to think about the future country where you're going to move to. So, yeah, it's too much for people to undertake. But that's what McLuhan was doing. That's what she aspires to.
Not necessarily what McLuhan was doing, but she is. This is a book for academics almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then,
because he's trying to correct the academic bias in media studies.
Right. So a few lines down, she says, as well, I wanted to demonstrate that McLuhan had not only read and understood Pound or Joyce, but also, most importantly, he had turned their aesthetic achievements into effective tools to explore and grasp the implications of their action and of new knowledge in their own time. I hope I struck a chord there. So then she goes on to say in this chapter, she's going to open up her dialogue, but she's already talked about it already, putting literature, art, and high-tech together. So it's as we've been saying, it's repetition to make a point. And
you might look at the next sentence. So in the following chapters, my goal is somewhat similar, as I hope to convince not only literary scholars, so that's academic, but also media theorists, that's another new kind of academic, media theorists, of the literary origins of McLuhan's ideas on media. That is, of the literary origins of media studies as per McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
This does not simply mean recalling McLuhan's training as a professor of English or his love of literature and the arts. Instead, it implies a deeper understanding of the role that literature played in the making of McLuhan as a, quote, media oracle, media guru, and modernist fan. And then she puts in brackets, your choice, of course, but if you stay with one mask, you will miss the whole persona. And I wrote in quadrophenia beside that. You must notice the quadrophenia. Mm-hmm. So she's providing fodder for explain my essay on McLuhan. Mm-hmm. In particular, it implies a different take on avant-garde literature, to understand it as a tool conducive to the development of a new way to approach and perceive both the history and the actuality of McLuhan's media studies. Now, that's what I was doing for years before Ion showed up. Now, Ion brings in a whole new thing that makes McLuhan irrelevant, but I don't mind talking about it, going back and getting into that old meme. Mm. But I like to say McLuhan anticipates Ion. So
right, so we have a place to go with what we talk about.
Yeah, but
or what you talk about it.
But the world's getting more and more intense, so I don't think the academic enterprise has any usefulness in the world anymore.
Right, so yeah, they have to keep trying to carve out a place for themselves.
Yeah, because they are, for some perverse reason, dedicated to older media. Mm. And it would be a leisure activity. Anybody should be able to go and listen to someone who studied, you know, McLuhan or something old and let them talk about it. You get a little taste of it. That's what we're doing here. We're providing a little hobby for people to worthwhile know about.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, it's harder to even talk about this stuff in light of our new progress that we're making.
Right. Well, in light of the way the world is going.
But in light of our own successful developments.
Yes. But what you're implying then is universities are defunct. Professors have no role anymore.
Right.
But doesn't...
They're the new old regime.
Yeah, but doesn't literature provide sort of a grounding for people, something that people can discuss and identify with, something that relates the philosophies of the time?
That's a book club. You might as well just form a book club, because you can't stop these people as they get absorbed into their black mirror.
Right.
So that's where they're going, and you got to learn about handling that. That's actually the new media ecology, which I call a paramedia ecology. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how we can carry on going through this without saying the same thing every time.
I know, but what's maybe just the next sentence caught my eye, or the next quote, I should say, because it is someone trying to define media studies, and I think that's kind of important to figure out what on earth people are talking about. And it's got some guy named Valdivia.
Yeah, Angarad N. Valdivia. Might be an Asian Indian name.
So he or she says, the dynamic interdiscipline of media studies, dot, dot, dot. Media studies is a relatively new interdiscipline, roughly dating back to the 1920s. I mean, just look at that. Here we are 100 years later. To them, it's relatively new, whereas our Black Mirror crowd, the newest thing is a new app that came out yesterday, and then next week they'll throw it over for another one. So 100 years to them is crazy. So right there is the disenfranchisement of university.
Yeah, and a lot of people go into university and they get a job, an assistant professor or an adjunct in that, and they get paid nothing, and they're overworked. It's actually a very bad profession right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess if you get to be a professor, full professor, then you write old stories like this that we're reading.
Yeah, you have to keep producing essays or books. So media studies is a relatively new interdiscipline, roughly dating back to the 1920s as a set of studies and the 50s as a formal discipline. The contemporary situation is such that as an interdisciplinary field, media studies has no easy boundaries or parameters. It draws on some of the most established disciplines, both in the...
No, it draws on some of the more established disciplines.
More established disciplines, both in the humanities and the social sciences, such as history, political science, sociology, psychology, anthropology, linguistics, and literature. Media studies also has great overlaps with newer disciplines and interdisciplines such as cultural studies, popular cultural studies, film studies, American studies, journalism, communication, speech communication, education, ethnomusicology, to name a few. So they're just saying it's a study of everything.
Yeah, and because they university is a leisure society function, that if you're not into the business or science part, you're just doing bird courses, and you can do it on anything. You can write your PhD on Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing the humanities fragment into anything, your papers, anything you can get away with.
Anything goes, yeah.
And they're calling that interdisciplinary.
That's
but
right.
They're on the sidelines and have nothing to do with what's going on. I recommend all you do is study McLuhan and Finney's Wake. That was the final interdisciplinary relevant thing.
Yeah.
So the rest is just a bunch of people doing hendiadies, more of the same.
More, yeah.
Each generation is doing hendiadies, just adding redundancy to what was completed by Joyce and McLuhan.
Well, yeah, it's like we've drilled it down to the things, the roots. The roots. My roots are minerals and yeast overgrowth. Your roots are McLuhan and Finnegan's Wake.
And Zappa.
Oh, Zappa. Okay, so then she comments on this, of course, and says, to many the above might sound like an evolving epistemological chaos. To others it might appear as the final accomplishment of cross-hybridization inside the humanities. Somehow it seems very much in tune with some of the dynamics pertaining to our own global village today, at least in terms of overlapping of previous boundaries, cross-fertilization, and contamination of cultural phenomena, as well as, why not, marketing of new approaches to old issues. And yet, such a blurred situation needs to be translated into university curricula, syllabuses, and all that makes media studies a popular but also recognizable field of investigation, production, and expertise within higher educational systems. So just lasso it all together and pull it back into the syllabus.
Yeah, you find that the books these people write are just annotating and processing their reading.
Mm-hmm.
They have 100 books at the back, and they just quote from one guy to the next and try to make a case, which is a puny case, and irritating. So I have no stock interest in these people, and they show their supreme ignorance by their lack of interest in what you do.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Madeline says, how can you be listening and engaging Ion and not talk to Bob or be interested in what we say when Ion's not around?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I say about these people. You've had the most resistance from these professors that come across you.
Uh-huh, yeah. They're so educated, they're sure they know more than anybody else. They reserve the right to be ignorant about anything except their specialty.
Okay, so, you know, when the mercantilism came in with the printing press and the beginning of literate capitalism, the feudal society's fallen apart, and they had little 14-year-olds running the armies. They could only get kids to run the last dynasties of the kings. So, let's see. You had the death of the salesman in the 40s and the takeover of the PR man. And then now you have people, and I guess part of the medieval transition is people being priests and the church trying to hold on to something.
Not people being priests, men being priests.
Right.
And relegating women to being whores.
Right, and then the Protestants trying to create a different situation. So today you have insecure people, neurotic people who can't do something in the present, and they don't want to work in a job, a hard office or industrial job, so they go to university and do a bird course and become a professor. It's the old regime. It's 14-year-olds being generals, but not for physical warfare, but for mental warfare. Mm-hmm. The old mind being hoiked up and made a supreme value. One of their main statements, these humanities professors, we must teach people to become critical. This whole thing to make develop. They say Americans, North Americans, aren't very critical, and they want to make you have a visual detached point of view and develop that. And it's such a useless activity when people are more and more getting sucked in and drawn into the Borg without a point of view. And so the book avenue of criticism doesn't work, doesn't make people a necessary critic, just makes you a nerd, an obsolete nerd who has ridiculous ideas and then gets to, and becomes a teacher and starts a cult about women should take over, and they develop feminist studies, and they get rid of James Joyce and McLuhan. You know, they
because
specialize.
They're too paternalistic or whatever.
No, they're too specialized in the chemical body. And they take some angle of the chemical body, and then make that the whole focus of knowledge.
The misogyny definitely comes in there. I mean, what did they relabel the McLuhan coach house?
Ms.
Understanding McLuhan.
Which means Ms. People, feminists, understanding McLuhan.
Yeah.
But it's really misunderstanding McLuhan.
Right, right.
So they're punning on that.
Right. Well, Bob, you know, the way you lay it out like that, it's no wonder the millennials are completely turned off to their world. There is no world for them.
Not in the old Gutenberg sense.
Nope.
So what's interesting, you see Jordan Peterson, he's the Don Quixote, the guy, you know, going after windmills. What are the windmills? The feminists, the queer studies, all these crazy humanity splinter groups, transgender studies. Peterson's on there, and I don't know if there are other YouTubes, but the only YouTubes I see are on the side, and they send Peterson YouTubes at me because I looked at a couple, and it's always, you know, Peterson slays another feminist. He's going on and slaying these feminists. So it's an interesting phenomenon. You get this one guy up against all these, the fragmentation and absurdities of academia on the humanist side. Mm-hmm. Now we know that there's a whole new science that we're growing. And so I don't even have respect for the scientists and the engineers who are doing their old shit and ignore what we're doing. So I'm filled with grievance tonight.
I hear it. Jordan Peterson, just looked him up, and just on the side, he comes from Edmonton. He's another one of these Midwest boys who has the perspective of the prairies, the long view.
The wide view, the non-visual perspective.
Yeah.
He has acoustic space view.
Yeah.
And he hops around from topic to topic. And, of course, he's coming from the same place McLuhan came from, Edmonton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But McLuhan moved there, away from there, quite early.
Right. So, like you say, I don't know how much we can rant on, but
well, you find the quotes that you're interested in.
Yeah, the next quote I'm interested in is a quote. So you just continue down; it'll be page 125, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's
always give me the paragraph, how the paragraph starts.
Yeah, it's in their introduction to this section dedicated to the Toronto School. The editors of Canonic. CANONIC, Ionic Texts in Media Research.
That canon means the main greatest hits.
Yeah. Canonic. How would you say it?
Canonic or canonic? Yeah, sure.
The editors of Canonic Texts in Media Research recall that, quote, Marshall McLuhan entered media studies through a side door and stormed onto center stage. A scholar trained in English literature, he shifted from an initial interest in media content to put all his weight on form, bracket, of which his Cambridge mentors might approve, bracket, and on technology, form and technology. By the medium is the message, the best known of his aphorisms. He meant that the dominant medium of each age uniquely constrains the way in which our brains process information, which in turn shapes our personality and our social system. So that's their analysis of McLuhan, which is, you know, it's superficial, but I think it does bring bring up the basics.
Yeah, so why is she quoting? What is she going to say about this?
Okay. She says, I will later engage with the idea that McLuhan entered media studies through a side door. Although in principle I agree with this statement, which recalls McLuhan's humanistic background. She always wants to bring it back to humanism. I agree with this statement, which recalls McLuhan's humanistic background as a starting point of his media studies. What bothers me here is the word uniquely in the sentence discussing the famous aphorism. If not otherwise commented upon, it inevitably reinforces the idea of McLuhan's technological determinism. In principle, I resist this association, as I have discussed elsewhere. So let's go back. In the quote, the book editors say, the best known of his aphorisms, by the medium is a message, the best known of his aphorisms, he meant that the dominant medium of each age uniquely constrains the way in which our brains process information, which in turn shapes our personality and our social system. So why is she taking umbrage at the word uniquely?
She says it smacks of technological determinism, which is what everybody thought McLuhan was in the 60s, and that's not very good in the academic level.
I see.
So she should explain here what she finds wrong, and she should prove how McLuhan's not a technological determinist.
Well, she'll try to prove he's a humanist, but he's both.
Right. In principle, she says, I resist this association, as I have discussed elsewhere. What I want to add here is that, in the particular case of McLuhan, that label does not convince me for several reasons. It reduces the complexity of his works to a linear interpretive cliché. It appears as a strategy developed by critics in response to the lack of direct political engagement in McLuhan's media analysis, so that his neutral works can be used for different causes. Not a negative strategy per se, but one which might encourage misinterpretations. It implicitly creates a persistent bias of seeing McLuhan as a media or techno fan convinced of the goodness of technological progress. Instead, I think that McLuhan was more an artsy fan, or even an artsy geek, not at all in love with technology, but a skeptic. He employed his literary studies as a counter-environment to better focus on both the functions and the side effects of a too much celebrated technological progress. So there she is hoiking up the real values of a literary critic. Mm-hmm. And I would say that she misses the point that McLuhan's works look technological determinists because they're put into a book. And the book reduces it to univocal, which then tends to make people think there must be a point of view here, and the point of view they come up with is technological determinism. She's missing out the fact that McLuhan, as a manipulative satirist, knows that his theories will be taken as technological determinism, and he wants that to be understood because that's the effect of the book.
Yeah.
The book makes him, you put McLuhan, who's a multimedia guy, you put him in a book, he comes across this way. So she wants to say, no, he's more complex. But Elena is missing the fact that McLuhan consciously knows the book will make that misinterpretation of McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
And so you that's how you learn what books do. They're a limiting medium.
Wow, very good, Bob.
So it's a very subtle point I'm making, rather than her point, which is, try to realize he had the complexity of deep literary studies, like Finnegan's Wake and modernist poets, more complex writings. And so that's another way of saying you guys are seeing McLuhan as a technology fan and missing the literary studies as his roots.
Techno fan, yeah. Okay. So then the next section is titled Evolutionary Grammarian. So what's she going to say here? I mean, taking the old grammarian title or whatever and saying he's evolving a grammarian view?
He is applying grammar to the new media.
Applying, yeah. So when you look up grammarian, it's a person who studies and writes about grammar. That's not true. The grammarian that these literary critics talk about is the old dialectic grammarian divide, correct?
Well, what? Who defined that?
They, like Plato and Aristotle were.
No, you read a definition. Where'd that come from?
Oh, I just clicked it on. I can click on it and I get a definition.
A dictionary.
New Oxford American Dictionary.
Yeah, it's a limited definition.
Okay, let me view the full definition. Not much more. Nope.
Okay, so you're saying that the Oxford Dictionary does not acknowledge the McLuhan's PhD, which goes into the trivium and the quadrivium.
Correct.
But that's not an issue, so carry on.
How much do we want to do this, Bob?
What do you mean?
Well, like you say, we're just repeating a lot of stuff. I mean, right now we're into technological determinisms. There are some words here we could say, but do we want to say them?
Well, here's something. She says, page 128, the paragraph, as I have discussed when introducing the mosaic, down near the last sentence, she says, of that paragraph, technological evolution is perhaps a better word than mere determinism, even though it is a process of selection, which in the case of technologies combines natural and artificial factors. Evolution also accommodates various possibilities, from adaptation to coevolution, from cooperation to speciation. These are terms which suggest a broader interplay and networking than mere determinism. So that's why she's bringing in the word evolutionary grammarian. It's a more flexible, maybe includes more factors, like an evolutionary process, so you don't get stuck with the noun technological determinist.
Very good. Yeah, I had that clip. So, technological evolution.
So you pick the next part.
Okay. I'm on the next page. It looks like 120.
Yeah, but what's the paragraph? It doesn't matter about the page. What's the paragraph begin with?
Right. Well, it's right below your, the next paragraph below yours, but the middle of the paragraph where it says, the manuscript is therefore presented as an example of a communicative tool merging two environments. A written text, literacy, was read aloud, orality, in monasteries or at courts to educate or entertain people. And yet the manuscript also created a more intimate approach to reading, as individuals could also be introduced to the pleasure of intimate readings, to a private interaction with this medium. The printing press made this possibility, private reading, available on a larger scale, accelerating a process which had already started in the Western world. So it was it's like a definition of the manuscript culture. And not much to be said about that. You want to do the next one?
No.
Then I have toward the end of this section, just before A Political Thomist, the paragraph begins, McLuhan's investigations appear to be even less deterministic when applied to the electric era, but I like the point where maybe one third down, she says, on the contrary, he often points out that he was simply probing the effects which he insisted always precede the cause. Now, I think we've even quoted that before. And then two lines down, if the dominant medium, bracket, a given technology bracket, was what uniquely constrains the ways in which our brains process information and then determines our personalities and social systems, we could easily foresee in a clear linear way what comes next. Bracket, we know the cause and anticipate the effect.